Hello, I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, creator of the Incandescent Radio Network, here with my friend and colleague, Tony Farmer, host of the Black Lives Matter radio show. We are thrilled you are here with us today, so let's get started. Hello, and welcome to the Black Lives Matter radio show on the Incandescent Radio Network. I am Hope Katz Gibbs, producer of the show and founder of Incandescent Incorporated. Here today with Tony Farmer, the host of the Black Lives Matter radio show, and our wonderful guest, Chris Armstrong, co-owner of Veritas Culture. He is a highly sought after consultant, facilitator, speaker, and coach in the areas of organizational culture, and especially diversity and inclusion, which will be the topic of our conversation today, D&I as they call it. Chris has been called to assess and repair culture and diversity and inclusion challenges around several high visibility national level situations, including the Charlottesville race riots, the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd, and the Kavanaugh confirmation. All totaled, he has facilitated more than 5,000 cultural sessions across more than 170 government, nonprofit, and private sector organizations. So we are thrilled to be here today with Chris. So Tony, I'm going to kick it over to you and you can take it away.
Chris, welcome. Thank you for spending some time with us this evening. And I kind of want to jump right into it because you and I know each other. We go back a little bit. We have a little bit of a history. I'm going to try not to make this too much fun. I want to focus on the issue. But let's start like this, right? So, softball, how did you get into diversity, inclusion, facilitation, and culture work?
I was a senior executive in the federal government, and I was bored out of my mind doing human resource type stuff. But one of the things I always liked was being the bridge between the workforce and the rest of the seniors. And one of the big gaps had always been just how people treated each other, the workforce feeling, you know, subjugated, the leadership feeling, generalized. But I think because of my age, quite frankly, I was able to sort of be a gap between the two. And that was certainly something, a skill maybe, that the director of the agency I was at the time saw, and he had asked me to be the culture executive based on it. We did a lot of good things, mostly the workforce. So my job is always, as you know, to really empower the collective, right? So it doesn't have to be me in the forefront. And so that's on the culture side. I think on the diversity, equity, inclusion side, I was a diversity executive, but that was also because I think for the same reason, I was always interested in being a bridge. And that was something that a lot of people needed because there were issues and no one knew how to talk to each other.
You've done a lot of work for a lot of people. A lot of it has been culture work. A lot of it has been diversity work. Tell me what happens when you walk into a room and people are expecting a person of color, right? They read your bio and, you know, they've seen everything you've done, which is incredible. You have an incredible background and breadth of experience. But when you walk into the room initially and people are expecting this, I don't know what they're expecting, but, you know, you can speak to the kind of receptions you get from people who don't look like you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the first 15 to 20 seconds, I think it's like, who's this guy? And frankly, I can understand why. But I genuinely think that after I start talking, it changes. And it's not because I'm the smartest person in the room. It's because I don't make it about me. It's because I automatically give the floor back to the people in the room. I don't believe in false relatability, so I don't practice false relatability. I think the facilitation approach, I guess what I'm saying is the facilitation approach has made it so that I don't get a lot of consternation in this field. And in fact, when I was a diversity executive at an agency, I won the People's Choice Diversity Award 3 years in a row as a white male, voted on by the workforce because I don't make it about me. Everything's in service of the group, always has been. So I think that's what happens. For the first 30 seconds, they're like, who's this dude? After that, they're like, oh, okay. And also, I think it's because I don't put on an air. Like, even as you've seen me before, I'll always be in a fedora. I'm always almost always in a music shirt. There are no pretenses. And so I don't think it's what they expect. Not only the skin color, but also how I dress and carry myself. And so they're like, oh, okay, maybe he's authentic. Maybe he is exactly, you know, what he is saying he is as the conversation goes forward. And I think that's what people want.
So, Chris, you mentioned the music. You're an expert facilitator, a certified master facilitator, might I add. Tell me how the music weaves into what you do and why that's important to you.
I think one of the biggest things about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that I've always been very heartfelt about is this reality that unless you're a white, heterosexual, able-bodied male, you can't bring your authentic self into the workplace. You have to show up differently. You have to try harder. And music is such an authentic part of who I am. So it's like, you know, and clothes, of course, I love clothes. So imagine if I were to walk into a room and because I have a red fedora on, people would judge me differently. They don't, and that's privilege. And I've always believed that, I've always believed it's privilege for me to be able to do a song of the day every single day when I start a meeting and no one wonder like, you know, where is this dude coming from? But they would have different thoughts if I were a female, if I were a person of color. So I weave the music in now, in an almost sort of defiant way, like I'm about to release something and people are gonna know it because then everybody else is gonna release something about themselves and whether you like it or not, who cares? People have to be able to be who they are. And I think the other thing about the music is I always do, as you know, a song of the day before I open any facilitated session. And people learn things about people they wouldn't have known. And in fact, you know, first time we did a song of the day and you said who your song of the day was, it was by Billy Joel. And there were people in the room who were like, And that's a good thing because we draw assumptions. We draw conclusions about who people are. So I like it as a way for people to grow and learn about each other, but also it's who my authentic self is. And I want to use that to let other people be their authentic selves.
A couple of fastball pitches for you. So once when the Black Lives Matter started, which was, of course, sparked by the death of George Floyd, who did you deal the first couple of phone calls with? Who were those people? You don't have to give me the names, but, you know, where did they sit in your life? And what did you tell him? What was the conversation?
So the first call I actually got was from Minneapolis, which is where we flew the week after. But if you talk on a more personal level, my business partner, who you know, Vince Brantley, and that call, and I'm comfortable sharing because he shared it with 100 people, was him telling me that he got a call from somebody who was asking if he was okay. Mm-hmm. And he was like, why? Because I'm moving. You know, did something happen that I don't know of? But they were making an assumption, and you and I had this conversation. They were making an assumption that because of the color of his skin, that he must automatically be in a particular place. And whether he was or not isn't the point. The point was, the first call I took was him sort of, you know, calling me and talking about how it's just funny to him that people who've never called him or haven't talked to him in months and years all of a sudden are checking in on him. And I think the second call I got was from, I'll just say, a family member who may or may not have, attempted to dissuade me from going to Minneapolis, but B, more importantly, may or may not have attempted to remind me, and I'll put that in air quotes, that he did have a criminal record.
Okay. All right. Oh, the George Floyd meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, gotcha. Interesting.
Interesting or racist or generalistic or, you know, but yeah, because they knew, they know what field I'm in and they knew where I was about to go. And let's just say we don't see eye to eye or ear to ear.
So tell us a little bit about that experience, Chris, somebody that calls you who thinks that they can associate with you because you look the same as them, right? You know, some of your Caucasian partners or friends or you told us a little bit about family, but tell me what your interaction is with those. And I love the way you couch this, the heterosexual white males, right? Tell me
let's
what
just
kind
make
of
an
interaction.
White, yes. Heterosexual, able-bodied males, wham.
That's hilarious. tell us what kind of conversations you have when you're trying to close the space and bridge some gaps in communication.
So generally speaking, when people first see me who look like me, they make assumptions that I'm probably in the same camp they're in, regardless mm-hmm. of what, you know. And 100% of my conversations with people are facilitation, as you know, 100%, good or bad, right or wrong. And I say that to say, I remember someone else, we went to a client site a couple weeks later and we were on a break and someone came up to me and said, man, the things you must hear, you know, you must get tired of all this so-called racist stuff. So my interactions go something like, so tell me more. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to put words in their mouth.
Right.
And they'll say something to the effect of, well, you know, I know you do a lot of facilitation, you know, and as a white guy, it's got to be hard to hear everybody say that everything's tied to racism. Okay, so what I hear you saying is that it's got to be hard for me to hear. Why do you conclude it would be hard for me to hear that? And right then and there, they're like, okay, maybe this isn't going to be the conversation I thought it was going to be. But it doesn't take long for me to, you know, get to a point where I might say to them, so help me understand why somebody might say everything's tied to racism. And the bottom line is they either believe in systemic racism or they don't. And every now and then I'll be able to put on my teacher hat because they'll say, okay, I'm interested. Tell me more. And I'll just ask a basic question or I'll tell a basic story about Larry and Chris. And it goes something like this. And it's very quick. Larry and Chris are both in 1962, the day after the Civil Rights Act was signed. Chris is white. Larry's black. Theoretically, the day after the Civil Rights Act was signed, they can both apply for a job. So which one is more likely to have the money the day after the Civil Rights Act was signed to get groomed to buy a suit? And people always say, well, probably you, Chris. Okay. Which one is more likely to be looked more favorable by the interview panel? Well, the day after, probably you. Okay. Which one's more likely to have a resume that's closer to what the panel is looking for in terms of qualifications to include education? Well, probably you. So which one of us two get the job? Well, probably you. What does Larry get? Well, he probably has to get a lower paying job. Okay, freeze. If Larry gets a lower paying job and Chris gets a higher paying job and they both have kids, whose kids are starting off from a better place? Well, probably yours. Okay. So then if my kids have kids, whose kids are, you know, who's starting? Well, I get your point. So that's systemic racism. You either believe it exists or you don't. And if you believe that it exists, then you'll understand why people complain, realistically speaking, why everything's tied to racism. Because the Civil Rights Act being signed or any document being signed does not change people's hearts and minds, no matter the fact that 24 out of the 50 states didn't want to enact it. And so they slow rolled it. That's the typical conversation I have.
And what is, once you bring about that awareness, do you feel like, you know, they get it, they don't get it? Do you feel like there's lights that pop on?
I would say I would put people into three categories. I would say the culture vultures don't ever get it. Mm-hmm. They asked the question for the purpose of trying to presume that I was like them. And once they figured out I wasn't, even if they sat through the discussion, they're going right back to. I would see on the far end is culture champions. They get it. They press forward, but that's a very small percentage of people. Most people in the middle get it, but they're not necessarily willing to change. Why? Because they're scared. Their perception is someone else's loss is theirs, or someone else's gain is their loss. So what we have in this country today, for instance, is 70 million people voted for Trump. Fine. Not fine as in good, but fine. Push that aside. And we're all excited that 73 million or however many voted for Biden. But just because someone voted for Biden doesn't mean they're going to be willing to do the things necessary to equalize access and opportunities. So I say that to say the majority of people I talk to are in that middle space I call culture sculptures, because they're just sort of there. So they'll be reticent to it. They'll listen to it. Will they actually take a step forward and do the right things? I haven't seen it yet. Society hasn't seen it yet. We do feel good things here and there. We grieve when Ahmaud Arbery gets shot, and then 2 weeks later, something else is in the news. George Floyd's grieve process lasted a little bit longer. But here we are, more worried about the election and other things. So in most cases, it doesn't go anywhere because I watch it from afar, and I, as you do as well.
So, Chris, I am pleased to say that one of the calls that I got after the Black Lives Matter movement started was from Hope. And, you know, Hope and I have known each other going on 4 years now, and I have come to know her as a deeply thoughtful and compassionate person. Right. So when Hope called me, she was, you know, and Hope is a mover, right? She is I am struggling to call her an activist, but she's about action, right? I'm calling you, Tony, because I want to do something. I'm not calling you just to check on, on you, which he did, but I'm calling because I want to do something. So for the hopes of the world, what do you tell them to get them thinking and moving in the right direction?
I think one of the first, so hope would be an enduring ally, right? Whereas you're a lived experiencer. Everyone else is somebody, it's somebody else. And so one of the things I always say is that one of the hard things about being an enduring ally or a lived experiencer is by numbers alone, I'm not talking about color of skin, you're in the minority, by numbers alone. So why does that matter? What matters there is we, it's easy for us to get frustrated at everyone else, the sympathists, the conflicted souls, the number crunchers, the post apologists, all those people, the supremacists for that matter. It's easy for us to get frustrated. And rightfully so, we should be frustrated. But what we do with that frustration is going to determine whether anyone else becomes an enduring ally. In other words, we have to be able to look beyond our longstanding allyship and say, that sympathist who knows something's wrong but doesn't know what to say, I have to figure out how to bring them in. That conflicted soul who knows that the killing of George Floyd was wrong, but struggles to see it as a systemic issue, we have to bring them in. Because this is counter to some advice that people give. And now you and I've talked about this, Tony, where somebody says, you can only worry about what's in your own backyard. I don't buy that at all. We have to bring sympathists, conflicted souls, even number crunchers into this, which means we have to figure out how to talk to them, which more importantly means we need to figure out how to listen to them. Because we don't listen to understand, we listen to respond. They say something, we don't fully agree with it, or we think that they're part of the problem, which maybe they are. So we just sort of push it away. You as an enduring ally, me as an enduring ally, you, Tony, as a lived experiencer, we have to figure out how many other people can we make enduring allies. And it's all about listening to understand.
One of the things that you've had to deal with, and I know at least this year, is you are very good at demonstrating, and you've actually taught me how to listen neutrally, right? Put on a neutral audio tape, right? So that when people say things, you don't judge, you know, you don't make generalizations, you don't try to pigeonhole people. But Chris, you are an enduring ally, right? So I've seen you have to deal with, okay, you're teaching people how to listen neutrally, but I see you, you know, writing these stuff and making commentary and creating content that is pushing the agenda. How do you navigate that?
So there's always six words I go by, and they are neutral in discovery, passionate in execution. And the last three words are what keeps me in the neutrality zone in the discovery piece, meaning there's times where I grit my teeth, you know, listening to someone. Now on the inside, you'll never see it on the outside, right? Level three and all that. But I'm hearing somebody who says something like, well, you know, you realize that George Floyd actually said, I can't breathe several times before the cop was on his neck, which means he could have just been messing around. How was the cop supposed to take it seriously? And so I'm listening to that, and I'm back in my mind, like you say, but the neutral in discovery means that whatever comes out, I can hold on to, and the organization can hold on to. Imagine if I were biased in discovery. So this guy works for an organization. I'm biased in my questions. I'm biased in my listening. And then I give the leadership an assessment. The assessment doesn't mean anything because I was biased. If I could be neutral in discovery, then I give them the assessment. They buy off on the assessment. He doesn't have any leg to stand on. Like, you know, this guy was, you know, asking me leading questions, putting words in my mouth. He was upset the whole time. They agree with it. I can be passionate in execution. My neutrality stops once that conversation ends. When I give somebody an assessment like the city of Minneapolis the week after the, and you know this because we've done work together, we don't just walk away. But we can be passionate at that point though, because no one's going to be able to say that we came in with an agenda. So to me, I balance it by saying, if I can't, there is no end state. They'll bring someone else in. So I have to be neutral in discovery so that I can help make change on the other side. And I'll just give you one very quick example. We had an observer facilitate with us, somebody who passed the certification, but they lost it for a half a second. When it came to us giving the assessment, the leader had already heard about it and said, one of the participants was concerned that one of your facilitators may have may have disagreed with something they said, and it was pretty apparent. So guess what we had to do? We had to redo the conversations.
Wow.
Without that facilitator and without me. Because even though I didn't lose my neutrality, I was still part of the initial discussions.
Right.
We can't have change unless we could be neutral in the discovery and then passionate in how we execute it.
So let me ask you, for the years that you've been doing this, and as Hope mentioned, you've done facilitations for a number of organizations across the spectrum, you know, over 5,000 times. Is there anything that still surprises you that comes up in a facilitated conversation?
I think the thing that still surprises me, and we're talking specifically diversity, equity, inclusion facilitation. I think the thing that still surprises me, whether it should or not, is particularly in the government space or more regulated spaces, people are still comfortable using words that you want to use 30 years ago, but may have used 50 years ago. And I'm not talking about inciting words like the N word. Somebody said in a session a few weeks ago when we were at one of the Army bases, someone said, well, you know, the colored people. And it's not that I don't think people are still racist or ignorant. I would think that somebody would, even if that was in their back of their mind, would watch their tongue strictly because of the environment they work in. Again, very policy laden, sort of regulated environments. But here's what surprises me even more. In most of the cases when that happens, and of course, Vince is with me almost all the time. Vince is a Black male. What ends up happening is the person apologizes almost the second it comes out of their mouth. And the other people in the room who are women or people of color, so anybody from an underrepresented group, are honestly, in most cases, defending the person. Because what they'll say is,
oh, they didn't mean that. They had an off day.
They'll say, I know this person. He's ignorant. He's from a different time. Because generally speaking, the person is older when that happens.
Gotcha.
I'm sitting here like, did you just say? But my level three, of course, is my level three. That's what surprises me, I guess, still.
What are you most proud of after all this time facilitating, and what have you accomplished that you can look back and go, wow, that was pretty good?
Well, I'll just say this. There are two things I kept with me, and actually I just unpacked it, you know, my new house, of course. There's only two things I've kept from my government service, and that was two out of my three People's Choice Diversity Awards. To me, the workforce saying that is a lot more important than something I would get from the leadership down. Because it's a workforce saying, we see what you're doing. But I would say the thing I'm most proud of is probably, honestly, developing other facilitators. Mm. Watching, going into an organization where they presume that you're going to be there for 3 years, you know, they put out a rec and our request for proposal, we only bid 1 year, they're scratching their head like, you know, what are you doing? And the first thing we tell them is, we can't be the long-term answer. You don't want us to be the long-term answer. Well, who's going to do it? Well, your workforce. But they're not trained. We're going to train them. Really? You're going to train yourself out of a job? Yes. Because if you're going to improve collective regards, you got to train the collective, right? So watching the collective go through the training and sitting in the back of an auditorium and watching them do the town hall where they brief the assessment to the workforce. And Vincent and I just sit there chilling like, good. And then we can leave. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So Chris, 2021, looking toward the future, we have the first female African-American woman. I said female and woman. That's such an oxymoron, right? Hope is going to lecture me on that later. But a woman of color in the White House, right? From your station, from your lens, what's that mean?
I'm going to give you two answers, and one of them is going to, yeah. So the first thing I think it means is that for the people who didn't think we were going to get there and maybe who didn't want us to get there, they're going to have 4 more years of checking themselves and trying to figure out where they belong. And to me, that is uber important, because a lot of people are in the cut. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing about we're surprised again that, you know, that it was that close or that many people voted. Most of the people who supported the current administration didn't come out and say it. So the people who are looking at the first female president, black president, woman of color. Most of them who are like uneasy about it are in the cut. They're not out and about, and they're going to have to check themselves, and they're going to have to figure out what that means. But I think the thing that it means most for the country is inspiration. I've seen so many pictures on LinkedIn where parents who are professionals on LinkedIn would take a picture of their back of their child's head watching the TV, watching her. And I don't think even a lot of allies, I won't say enduring allies, even a lot of allies don't get how much hope changes when it actually happens. Because we keep telling people, be hopeful, you know, smile, you know, things are going to get easier, that kind of stuff. Until you see it, there's inspiration there. All the girls, all the little girls especially, and especially black girls, girls of color, can now say it's happened. But and she'll be here 8 years, if not more. So that'll be even better.
Oh, interesting. So you and I have very limited political conversations, but I will just say for hope in our audience, you are a bit of a soothsayer when it comes to politics. So if you're saying it, I'm claiming it and believing it, right? Given what you have told us, Kamala's impact is going to be on the country and some of the changes that people are going to have to make, how does that impact your work?
Well, I think the easiest answer is we can tear up that executive order that went out that says no D&I training in the government. That'll be out the window, like a red toupee. Let's see here. How else will it change my work? I think that we're going to be able to have less training and more authentic discussion in the form of to replace training. All we've done the last 20 years, and you know it better than most, is unconscious bias training and no fear training and compliance this and compliance that, none of which changes hearts and minds. And I think we're going to have a progressive OPM, a progressive GSA, a progressive group of politicians, you know, in various posts. And we're going to be able to get real. And again, those people in the cut are going to have to figure out, where am I?
Right.
Where am I? Unless, of course, we start hearing more conversations about, you know, states seceding and all that, whatever stuff. But I think it's going to be a lot better for my work, but more importantly, for the impact.
What's the biggest challenge you think Kamala is going to have moving forward?
I think the biggest challenge, two. One is going to be being taken seriously, because she has intersectionality all over her.
Yeah.
Both gender and race, and multiple races for that matter. And just being taken seriously. The second thing I think, and I hate to say this, but I think it's just true. And the reason I think she's going to be in for at least 8 years. She's a bit more, and by a bit, I mean a lot more progressive than Biden. She just is. He's a little more old school. And I say that just to say, there's going to be people wanting her to take more of the reins because of that. And she's going to have to figure out, you know, how do I do that? And that's sort of any politician or any, you know, sort of political thing. But, you know, for instance, there's already been discussion about, you know, should the Democrats stack the deck on the Supreme Court, given, you know, what just happened? Biden's already said he's not interested in it. You know, but his chief of staff, big on Supreme Court, you know, she's going to get a lot more of that, because he'll be up and out, she'll be down and in. And I really think she's going to, that's going to be one of the challenges she's going to have. And I'm not saying she can't do it, but it's just going to be one of the challenges that face her, that, you know, that sort of look in her direction.
So another fastball, I'm going to put a curve on it, a little spin on it. So we've all been witness to the largest global pandemic of my lifetime and most people that I know. How has this impacted D&I work from your lens? And then what do we need to do to recover?
I think it's made D&I work harder for two reasons, maybe three. One, it's easier, and you know this again, it's easier to bring people together when they're in the same room. when there's some relatability you can build, right? And you certainly, it's harder to do that. Not impossible, but it's harder to do that virtually. I think number two, now that it is virtual, D&I work for anybody virtually who's in an underrepresented group, right? Let's just call a spade a spade. If we're talking about women or we're talking about people of color, what they're having to deal with now is, and again, this is where I'm just going to call a spade, higher percentage of single parents. So what that means is that their home is now their office is now their home is now their office, and trying to separate those while managing kids, that has a harder impact on people who tend to need the benefit of diversity and inclusion work on the, you know, on the receiving side. Whereas managers, you know, can just sort of be where they are. It also gets to this reality we talk about inclusion. It's easier to include someone in a staff meeting, have them come with you to a meeting, sponsor someone in a building. It's harder to do that from afar. So now we're telling managers, you were already having to figure out what to do to authentically sponsor and mentor women and minorities, people with disabilities, members of LGBTQIA+. Now you're going to have to figure out how to do that from afar. And now you're going to have to do that while also being mindful of their home situations, because statistically speaking, they're harder than your home situations.
Right.
So I think those are all things that make it more difficult, quite frankly, because they've never heard that kind of advice before. And so now that they're working from home, your GS6 secretary, I hate that word, administrative assistant. Or, you know, if you're in the private sector, your administrative assistant who makes $35,000 a year probably doesn't have a printer and a copy machine and a laptop. You're going to buy those for them? Well, I can buy my own. Well, that doesn't, you're not them and they're not you. Like, that whole sort of education is harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, post the vaccine and post, you know, how does D&I recover? How do you see that happening?
Well, how does it recover? I think the good thing, again, about the new administration at the time of the pandemic, not that we want the pandemic at all, is we're going to be able to see D&I differently. We're going to be able to manage it differently. We're going to be able to educate it differently, or, you know, sort of fix it differently. One of the big things is, for instance, you know, this joke around the business case for diversity, mm-hmm. like you needed a business case to hire all the white people in your organization. Of course you didn't. But now what COVID has done, at least on a couple of levels, is it has at least put a spotlight on, oh, maybe people can actually work from home. Maybe people can get stuff done, you know, without you having to look at them all day, sort of thing. And I say that to answer your question, to say, with that happening, the new administration coming in, and quite frankly, with most, I'll just say, people 40 and under being on the right side of this, I think the recovery is going to be fairly simple, if not having to revert and transition from in-person training focused, compliance based, to virtual societal focused, right? Equity over diversity, for instance, and with a lot more champions. I really think the pandemic has just made it so that it's going to be virtual instead of in person, but I do think everything else is shifting in the right direction anyway. Especially the younger generation, they grew up with diversity and inclusion. It wasn't even a thing.
Yeah. So Chris, here's the next curveball, and I can't tell you how much fun I'm having. We'll talk about that later too. But so, and this question stems from, you know, I like picking on you, and I know you really well. So I'm so curious to see how you're going to answer this question. But you're standing in front of a group of middle school kids, and you're trying to facilitate a conversation with them on what D&I is going to mean in the centuries to come. What do you, Chris, want these children to know? And just imagine that these children are from a number of different backgrounds. You know, what do you want them to know based on your experience and some of the things that you've gleaned over the years?
So you threw me a curveball. I'm going to throw you a curve answer.
I would expect nothing less from you, Chris.
I wouldn't talk about diversity and inclusion. I would talk about equity and belonging. And I would say that to say, for them, equal access and opportunities is going to be more more of an outcome, more of a certainty for them, because the people that are one and two generations ahead of them are already pushing in that direction. And that as you're going into high school and as you find yourself picking your college, right, presumptive communication, you're going to be picking your college. I want you to pick it, not based on what you see sitting here today, but based on what the work you see your brother and sister generations a couple years older. And what I would probably do just in terms of talking about the background, like, is we have focused a lot on diversity and inclusion, but the reason it hasn't gotten us anywhere is because we haven't done anything to equalize access. And of course I would use simpler words, but you can do all the recruitment at colleges you want, but if you don't build any pipeline from earlier on so that people can actually take the steps, it doesn't matter. And then the last thing I would do, and this won't surprise you because we've done it before, is I would call one of them up and we'd facilitate the rest of the discussion.
That's exactly what would happen. No doubt there. Chris, last question. And just to give you some foresight on how Hope and I do this, you know, I kind of do my questioning, or I throw my different types of baseballs, and then I give Hope the last word, right? What gives you hope, right? What, looking forward, based on everything we've seen up until this point and based on all the work you've done up to this point, what still gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that, generally speaking, because it's a Black Lives Matter podcast, I'll be more specific, Black and African Americans, by and large, have had enough and they're showing it. What gives me hope to stretch that into a real example is when I look at LinkedIn, I see different pictures. I see different hair. I see authentic language as opposed to, people having to code switch. That gives me hope, because as long as people adjust, we don't have to. So me as a white heterosexual able-bodied male, wham, as long as women adjust to me, I don't have to adjust. As long as Blacks and African Americans adjust, I don't have to adjust. And I'm just using I as an example. I like that people have stopped adjusting and they've made it known. You want to call me unprofessional because of how I wear my hair? How do you define professional? And who gets to define it? Like, all of those challenges are coming up. And so those middle schoolers that we'd have a conversation with, they're seeing different pictures. They're seeing different movies. They're seeing different directors. I that's what gives me hope. Because like we said earlier, talk is cheap, but we're actually seeing it. There's a whole New York Times article about it. They call it Black LinkedIn.
Okay.
Yeah. That gives me hope.
Awesome. Hope, over to you for the last question and to get Chris out of the hot seat.
Chris, you're awesome. I'm so thrilled that you're on this show with us. And, you're working with Tony, who is one of my heroes. He's fantastic. And I just am so impressed by the work you're doing. So I think my question to you is, actually, I'll sidebar for a second. A lot of the work that I'm also doing is through my Incandescent Women magazine to bring voice to women in power, because I feel like if we give people a platform, all of the incandescent work is about this, to give people the opportunity to say, you know, what it is they need to say, and so that we can all understand better. So my question is, where do you see the world in terms of women and diversity and fairness, right? So that there's equity somehow, right? Because it's so systemic and it so begins in the beginning. What do you see the world looking like in 5 years?
The way it looks right now, I think it's going to take us 10 to 15 years, because we really genuinely need to get one more generation of people, I'll just say out of power. I'm not going to be grim about it, but out of power, and one more generation, younger generation of people into that lower echelon of voters, lower just by age. If everybody who could vote today voted, it would be a landslide every single time. We know that. And I say that to say we need law changes, but more importantly, we need human change. And the human change is going to come when the people who are in power today are no longer in power and they're replaced by women, people of color, and I'll say white males, but white males who share power and who don't fear loss just because someone else gains. And I think that's 10 to 15 years away, just from a generational perspective. And I say that because when we facilitate, there's a noticeable difference with the people in the room. There just is, with age, gender, and generation in terms of what they believe and what they're willing to seed, but it'll be there.
40 years in the desert, right? Get to shake it off somehow. You know, I will add something. My daughter is living with a Black man in Richmond, Virginia, and she is so devastated by this. She feels like when she communicates this with me, and I may not be articulating this completely properly, but she's so furious and she wants to do something and she's trying to figure out what she can do at 25. Because she sees his family and they're very sort of old Richmond, right? The heritage of that community. And so what would you say to her?
In terms of what she can do? Mm-hmm. I think one thing that she could do, and I'm not gonna say it's easy to do, but I think one thing she could do is she could join local advocacy groups. But I would say another thing she can do is join the club, become a facilitator. She wants a seat in my class. I'll give her one for free. I mean,
she would love that. Okay. We'll talk about it. Because, you know, I mean, there are young people like her who are so, you know, they don't have the tolerance that we were sort of like entrenched in, right? And I have no tolerance for it, but I understand it and it breaks my heart. Like the situation, like I read in your bio in the very beginning, Charlottesville, my son was at UVA that year. And just like, how could that happen? But of course it did. And George Floyd and the catastrophe. And I actually had someone said to me, well, just what they said to you, you know, well, he had a criminal record. I'm like, what? You know, like that makes it okay that they.
But Robert Downey Jr.
Right. Right. You know, and it's just that. How do we, and what does the world look like? And I think that's my final question to you. What will the world look like when this is different?
I think the world will, I actually answered this a few days ago. I think we will go into places of business and the people who work, the demographic of employees will be less, women and people of color and more everyone. Because right now, one of the devastating effects you can see is almost everybody who serves you, everybody who drives a bus, everybody who operates a metro looks the same. And they don't look like me, generally speaking. That will change. When the world looks different, that will change. I think the other thing that will look different is the school systems will look different because we'll stop redlining, which is going to be different. And I think that because of those, the other thing that's going to look different is this idea of professionalism. And I don't just mean in the workplace, but in society. Everything that we were raised to believe is professional, from no tattoos showing to clean shaven to suit and tie, white shirt, all that's going to be different. And the reason that matters so much is because we believe what we see and we believe what we hear. And as long as we see and hear the same things all the time, anything that's different from that, we're going to perceive as bad and as wrong. And I'll just say to your daughter and her age, we just certified our first person in their 20s 2 weeks ago, Sue Calwaite's daughter, who aced the class for the exact reason your daughter would probably ace it. The passion is different because, as Tony will tell you, to do this kind of work, you have to have genuine curiosity. And people in that age range, generally speaking, have that curiosity because they're tired of it. So they're like, what can I do? So do something with that curiosity that will bring other people as enduring allies. Because again, we're still in the minority, us in lived experiences, we just are.
Thank you, that's so beautiful. And I will definitely connect you with my daughter, Anna, because, you know, I think kids like young people like her need guidance because they feel like they're just kind of banging around and they don't know which direction to go. And a lot of people, you know, young people, especially with that kind of passion and heart. So thank you for providing that service. And I'm gonna throw it back to Tony.
Well, Chris, I get the pleasure and the joy of beating up on you outside of this forum. So I'll look forward to that soon. But all kidding aside, I think you know that, you know, together our goal is to change the world in the best way that we are able. I am solely dedicated to that. You know that. And to the degree that I can bring people along, I would do that as well. That means you'll see a little bit more hope in the future as well. So thank you for taking the time out. Thank you, lovely wife, for allowing you to tear away from unpacking and moving and getting things set to spend a little time with us. And I look forward to seeing you soon, my friend.
like tomorrow. Thanks again. I will see you tomorrow.
Awesome. Yes, sir.
Nice to meet you. Yeah, lovely to meet you, Chris. We look forward to talking with you more and bringing more of your work to the Black Lives Matter radio show and other incandescent projects. You are listening to the Black Lives Matter radio show on the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, the producer, with Tony Farmer, host of the show. Thank you, Chris Armstrong. Be well. So that's all for today's episode of the Black Lives Matter radio show on incandescentradio.com. We have an amazing lineup of future guests, just like you heard on today's show. So be sure to tune in for another episode and tell your friends about us so they can listen too. If you or someone you know should be a guest on our show, send me an email, hopekatzgibbs@gmail.com, and we'll be in touch. Again, this is blacklivesmatterradioshow.com on the Incandescent Radio Network. We look forward to talking to you. Until then, stay safe and be well.